From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Work is about skill, and for most, work is also about social navigation. From the simplest things, eye contact, handshake, to some really gnarly challenges when workplace social life gets complicated. Ross McCammon has been handing out advice on that side of the equation. He's put it together in a kind of survive and thrive guide. This hour On Point, social navigation at work. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you good at this? Bad? Learning? What's your biggest challenge in social interaction at work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Ross McCammon, senior editor at Esquire magazine, business etiquette columnist for Entrepreneur magazine, and author of the new book, Works Well with Others, An Outsider's Guide to Shaking Hands, Shutting Up, Handling Jerks, and Other Crucial Skills in Business That No One Ever Teaches You. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ross McCammon, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Is this for everybody, or is this super specialized for a guy like you, Texan, showing up in Manhattan, not knowing the New York ropes?
Well, it's certainly the book that I wish I had been able to read 10 years ago when I sort of out of the blue got a call from a recruiter at a major media company in New York when I was living in Dallas and asked to, you know, he asked me to come interview. And so I said, yes, of course. But then I thought, wow, this is the big time. And this is a little intimidating. I feel like an outsider and I felt like almost sort of an imposter. And so, you know, this book is the sort of manual or handbook that I wish I had back then.
But is it Country Mouse comes to the city, or is this something that applies all over the place, Ross?
Well, I think it's partly that. Partly it's when this book is for people who feel like outsiders who maybe are starting either their first job out of college or their first, you know, big job at some point, you know, in their career. But it's also, I think, a book about the hidden landscape of sort of, you know, the hidden social landscape that we all experience, especially in an office setting. There's all these things that we do that we don't really talk about a lot. You know, the show, I think Ricky Gervais of The Office was the first person to really, you know, start highlighting some of those things and the sort of the weirdnesses of work. And this book includes a lot of that. But yeah, it's a guide for people who think, you know, that maybe they feel in over their head. But I think anyone who works in an office can certainly relate to it.
Some people may think, well, that's supposed to be the stuff of the Mad Men era or how to succeed in business without really trying. We're in a new age now. It's hierarchy. It all depends how good a coder you are or, you know, the unique skill that you bring to the workplace. Do you think all this social etiquette advice is as relevant as it once was, or are we past all that now?
As you can imagine, I think it's incredibly relevant. I think it's even more important than ever. At a time when we email a colleague who is literally right next to us, you know, or instant message.
Can you believe what he just said?
You know, and we're not, you know, getting up and going over and talking to each other face to face. I think now it's almost it's a more absurd landscape in a lot of ways, and so now we need that. You know, we need to kind of recalibrate, I think. And also, it's just, you know, I think that it's amusing a lot of these things that we do at the workplace. And also, the book is not, it's not just an entertaining thing. I think that it's a serious thing, you know, because a lot of these small things and the way we interact with people matter a ton. You know, it's not the kind of stuff that's stressed in college. It's not the kind of stuff that's stressed in your interview. But how you are, how you comport yourself, how you behave yourself at work is incredibly important.
So begin to take us in there. Here you were. You showed up from Texas and boom, you're in the big time. And what hit you as the first challenges? Where did your learning begin, Ross?
Well, my learning began in my interview. You know, that was my first taste of
job interview.
My boss.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, my job interview for Esquire. I'll never forget my boss. Shook my hand, but he got up from his desk and he walked around the table and he grabbed one of the two desk chairs that were in front of his desk and sat down in one and invited me to sit in the other. It was a very generous move, and it seemed to
put you side by side, sort of peers.
Yeah, and it seemed to be emblematic of something about the way this place works. There's a generosity in that, and I'll never forget it. But it also ended up being disarmingly interesting and a conversation. And I think sometimes when we are in job interviews, we forget that what we're doing is not necessarily – I think interview is almost the wrong word. Mm-hmm. That we're having conversation. I mean, these are real people, you know, who are sitting across from us. They have a lot of power and they have a lot of leverage. But we have power too. We have leverage too. And so that was I think that moment for me was it left a mark. But that, you know, that was just the beginning. And I was lucky in that worked out really well.
Let's pause right there, Russ, because that's where I began to feel something more contemporary about this. This wasn't about you're not writing them in the job interview, put on a good face, put on a good front. At the heart of your advice is be real. Show your real self. Many people might be a little disconcerted by that because mm-hmm. I've been thinking so much about what the guy wants to hire or the gal.
Of course. And, you know, I think that's the line that is very difficult to walk, certainly at work and also with this book. You know, there's a fine line between authentic and inauthentic. One of the things I recommend throughout the book is I think things that everyone already knows, and that is they act as reminders in the book, and that's how important eye contact is, how important a smile is, a true smile, not a fake smile, but a true smile, which is very difficult to pull off, how important a firm but not too firm handshake is. If you're not the kind of person who's inclined to do those things, if you are, say, an introvert, and I probably lean toward that side of things, it's okay to borrow from certain behaviors from the extroverts, in certain situations. I think, in the job interview is one of them. Your first day at work is another. And really, I think every day at work is a good time to do that.
I can imagine some people rolling their eyes now thinking, oh, what has happened? It is the Mad Men era. I am back in the 1950s. It's all about eye contact and a great smile and a firm handshake. It sounds like, Willy Loman could start there.
Yeah, but we live in a society, and when we work, mm-hmm. we work in a society, And I think, and one – there was a – I think it was a Columbia University study 2014. People don't – they found that people don't know how they come off. We don't know. We don't understand that if we're really serious at work and we're frowning and we seem a little glum, we feel like we're just hard at work.
Right.
But what other people get is – it's sort of off-putting. You're sort
of so dour, not friendly.
Exactly. You're not a part of the team. And when my first 6 months at the magazine, that's how I was. And finally, I went to an after work, the bar after work, and somebody said, "Why are you so glum?" And I thought to myself, "I'm not glum. I couldn't be happier to be here. This is my dream." But you don't notice what you're giving off. And so while I understand that there is, this idea, you could roll your eyes at this idea of performance, we aren't our true selves at work. We just aren't, I mean, there is a political element, this book has a lot of etiquette, but, etiquette is I think, it encompasses so many things. And part of it is a political element.
Has the idea of less hierarchy changed that? Do you buy that workplaces are now more democratic, more collaborative? Has it diminished the need for etiquette awareness or presentation awareness, or has it increased it somehow?
Well, I don't tackle the subject in the book, but I have to say I'm very skeptical about workplaces that present themselves as non-hierarchical or democratic. Again, I haven't studied it. I haven't been to I'd say 12, 13 years ago, I worked at an internet marketing company when that was first developing. And, you know, it was all about the team. It was everybody was, you know, on the same level. And there was the cool rock climbing wall in the corner, you know, and, and it's just, you know, have fun. It's work, but it should be fun. Bring your dog. Now, I happen to work at a much more hierarchical, you know, sort of corporate structure now. But I think they basically are the same. One of them just had a facade of you know, sort of being more democratic. But once those layoffs came around, you learned really quick that it was just as cutthroat as any other capitalist company in America.
So you're down and dirty in a hurry. You've got a whole chapter here on, and they're short chapters, but on how to intimidate people. Where are you going with that, Ross?
Well, I think intimidation at work is an inevitability. I think that you're going to intimidate people, and you are going to be intimidated by people. You know, there's two kinds, right? There's passive intimidation, and there's active intimidation. And I think passive intimidation
is one better than the other.
I think passive. Active intimidation is possibly illegal.
Okay,
and almost certainly
leave the baseball bat at home.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, that's what I talk about. I think that in the book, it's just an inevitability. You know, that you are going to, you know, you are going to intimidate certain people. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's not necessarily a bad thing for the person who is respected so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about navigating the workplace, social navigation at work in the 21st century, maybe any century. My guest is Ross McCammon, senior editor at Esquire, business etiquette columnist for Entrepreneur. If that sounds old-fashioned, he says it's not. His new book is Works Well with Others, An Outsider's Guide to Shaking Hands, Shutting Up, Handling Jerks, and Other Crucial Skills in Business That No One Ever Teaches You. And indeed, maybe they don't. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. What do you think? Is it easier these days with all the talk about flattened hierarchies and casual workplaces? Or is it harder when things get loose and undefined? What's got you stumped at work on relationships, interactions? Is your office its own sitcom? Can it be tough sometimes? You bet it can. Let's do a little East Coast, West Coast here. We'll start with the Devil Wears Prada, Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep, exacting in her demands for her new assistant, Andrea Anne Hathaway.
I need 10 or 15 skirts from Calvin Klein.
Okay, what kind of skirts do you...
Please bore someone else with your questions. And make sure we have Pier 59 at 8 a.m. tomorrow. And remind Jocelyn I need to see a few of those satchels that Mark is doing in the pony. And then tell Simone I'll take Jackie if Maggie isn't available. Did de Marchelier confirm?
De
Marchelier? Did he get him on the phone?
Okay.
And the Anne Hathaway character doesn't know quite what to say there. Ross McCammon's been there. Take it West Coast. Got the brand new Steve Jobs movie. Steve Jobs, played by Michael Fassbender, confronted by Steve Wozniak, played by Seth Rogen.
You can't write code. You're not an engineer. You're not a designer. You can't put a hammer to a nail. I built the circuit board. The graphical interface was stolen from Xerox PARC. Jeff Raskin was the leader of the Mac team before you threw him off his own project. Everything. Someone else designed the box. So how come 10 times in a day I read Steve Jobs as a genius? What do you do?
I play the orchestra.
All kinds of types out there, including the genius, jerk, we'll look at that, and much more. Ross McCammon in New York, questions, callers for you from around the country. Gina in Augusta, Georgia. Gina, you're on with Ross.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting because I work in an environment where I have folks. I'm real new. But I work in an environment where people have been there like 20, 25, 15 years, and they all hide each other's issues.
Yeah.
And it's really uncomfortable to try to navigate when you're bringing in a professional disposition and people want to operate in their own authority and their own supervision. And I find it to be extremely difficult to try to penetrate. I've tried a number of things from a number of books that I've read, but it still doesn't seem to make any leeway for me.
Gina, hang on right there. This is really interesting. So how new are you? How many months at the firm?
9 months.
9 months. People have been there a long time, Ross. And Gina, is it, I don't know, are they friendly and open? Are they intimidating? What's the vibe?
Oh, yeah. They're friendly and open, and they all know each other. A lot of cronyism, nepotism. They all know what's going on. They go to the doctors. They go get their hair done. They go do all kinds of things. And you're trying to penetrate an environment where people to have to cultivate an environment of work. We have to work, and it just doesn't happen.
All right, Ross, you're in the expert chair today. Advice for Gina.
Well, I think I can relate to what you're saying. When I came up to New York, and really this, I think every job I've ever started, I felt like I was outside of the tribe. That there was almost this tribal aspect to all workplaces, especially for people who have worked together for 10, 15, 20 years. They have just, you know, it's like they've all been married to each other and they just know each other's quirks and they can, you know, they can speak to each other almost without speaking and they can, you know, they're on a different wavelength.
So Gina wants to break in and she wants the work to be the focus here, you know, so it'll all be successful. What do you say?
Well, I mean, you know, I have a feeling that all of those people probably felt like she did, you know, at some point. And 9 months, I've always thought that the first 6 months to a year was almost just this training period, almost this introductory period for any workplace. And I have a feeling that after a while that things are going to change just because I think trust comes into it. I think that's a big thing. Trust and empathy comes into play. Now, in terms of changing the workplace culture, changing 20-year veterans and getting them to buckle down, unless you're in a position of authority, I'm not sure that's going to be possible. So it might be something for the person who is in a position of authority to take care of.
The old madman thing was, and maybe still was, you know, go out after work for a drink or something. Work your way in that way. What about those settings? Mm. What's your advice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that if there is that kind of culture, it certainly works for camaraderie. You know, one of the problems with going and having a drink in a bar is that if you're not a drinker, that can be really ostracizing and very uncomfortable if you end up going. Of course, you could just go and you know, order whatever you want and have a good time. I think that, you know, I think the social aspect of work is extremely important. And it's something that, you know, we don't, it's not in the employee handbook, but I think it's very important. But I don't think you have to be, I don't think that you don't have to do the extracurricular activities. You can do that in the workplace. You know, you can have flashes of humanity in the workplace. And I don't think that you have to concoct some elaborate scheme to hang out with your coworkers, you know, after work.
Gina, what's your strategy? Show your professional chops, show your social chops, flash your humanity. What's your tactic here, Gina?
My strategy has been that policy and procedure and just very limited socialization because, for example, this particular building has two floors, so my eyes can't be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is just say, well, you know, this is what we need to do. There's a central office. I run the show. This is a central office. Let everything come through that way. But it doesn't work. People just will not comply.
I'm a little worried about policy and procedure. You know, they're important, but if you lean too hard on those, maybe that's where Ross is right. You've got to have that human connection at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I've kind of done a few little things, but since last Friday, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to hang it up, and I just moved on. I just couldn't deal with it.
Oh, you're out. You're it's done.
I just left on Friday because I just cannot. I don't want to go down two different levels to try to have people work, which who are not in my authority. I mean, who are not in my academic environment. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
Well,
Gina, you remind us, Gina, this is deadly serious stuff. What do you say, Ross? It's over.
Well,
Gina, thanks for calling.
No, it is incredibly serious stuff. And obviously that has caused Gina a lot of distress. But, you know, I think on some level this might be a happy story because there are some places where we shouldn't work and there's some people who we don't get along with. And I think the earlier, and it sounds like Gina did a lot of thinking about that and a lot of observing and a lot of soul searching, for a lack of a better word. But I think it's a happy story. It's like what Louis C.K. says about you know, divorce. It's like no great marriage ever ends in divorce, you know? And I think, but I certainly, it's a hard time. It's a hard thing. I think there are situations that you just can't overcome. I mean, I talk in the book about, you know, if there's a particular person at work who is a roadblock, who is just takes being a jerk to a whole other level, that I think can be dealt with. But when you work in an office with a whole, you know, team of people who feel like they're on a different wavelength than yourself, well, you know, maybe divorce is the right move.
Sometimes it's time to just go. We'll talk about collaboration. We'll talk about giving, getting credit. Tereska in Miami. Tereska, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm the president of Aurora Executive Consulting, and I work a lot with the startup community.
Yeah.
And I see that one of their main challenges is to embrace a hierarchical organizational structure. Kumbaya, we're all friends, works great at the bar and in other social situations, but it's a real disaster at work, most particularly because your company cannot thrive if your staff, customers, and most particularly your outside investors don't know who the decision makers are and don't know who's in charge.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Tereska, you're an executive consultant, so you have to think that way, right? Because you want to train the top dogs.
Well, I don't want people to go bankrupt and get divorced, right? I want their companies to do really, really well.
Yeah.
So one of the main questions I always get is, how do we get money? How can we make our business grow? We've got a great idea. How do we put it into action? And usually you'll get a bunch of people who've been friends for a long time. Maybe they worked together at another office, and they did have, you know, they had a wonderful friendship relationship. But when it comes time to putting their ideas into operation, you need, and particularly if you want someone else to fund it, they need to know who they're talking to. Who's in charge of the finances? Who's in charge of hiring and firing? Who's in charge of finding the various locations, if that's what you're going to do? Who are we talking to? And that goes for customers as well. So, yeah, I do have I want people to hear about, like, how they have good business practices, because I want people to make money and have fun in life.
Tereska, I'm glad you raise it. Ross McCain on standby. I want to get a little second angle on this, if I may, from right in Tereska's backyard. Elizabeth Bernstein joins us from Miami, Florida. She's with the Wall Street Journal, writes the column there on relationship. It's called Bonds, a little double entendre there. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Can we just talk about relationships along the lines Tereska raises in your backyard in Miami there for a moment? Startups where the idea of hierarchy is sort of antithetical to how they've imagined themselves. Tereska says they've got to have it. How does that work out relationship-wise when young firms are trying to establish, you know, who's on top? Or is that old hat?
No, I agree with what she's saying. I think it's very hard. I understand she's saying, you know, often you see friends, they've come up with an idea, they're going to start a company, and unless there's really someone who's in charge of certain decisions, maybe someone else is in charge of others, where is it going? You're going to end up with no way to really communicate about decisions. If you come at it as just purely friends, everybody gets a vote that's equal, where does that go? I think that's, you know, what she's saying, and certainly outside investors want to see that there's somebody in charge, that there's a good plan for going forward in communication. So I do think that's hard. But on the other hand, you know, how do you navigate that when you've got good friends? Many times we spend so much time in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Most of us spend more time with our coworkers and with our families, which is kind of sad, but good too, because we become friends with these people. That helps a lot of organizations, you know, when we care about the people we're working with. So, but how do you navigate that is so interesting.
We're talking about social navigation at work in the 21st century with Elizabeth Bernstein, Wall Street Journal, and Ross McCammon, author of Works Well with Others. Elizabeth, what do you make of Ross's framing this around or through etiquette? I mean, that's his column at Entrepreneur. He doesn't use it in his title here, but a lot of this is about how to handle the subtleties of personal interactions at work. Is that, it can sound madmenish, but is that still a useful, important way of, is it inevitably, of coming at any group operation?
Sure. I think it's very, very important because you can be the best at what you do. You can be the best coder, the best writer, you know, the best executive, anything. But yet, if you cannot get along with other people, you really probably aren't going to last long. You've got to be able to communicate well. And that falls down to making the bonds, but also having manners and being able to get along and listen to other people as well. So etiquette in any situation and certainly in the workplace is important.
Of course, Ross means it in a pretty supple way here. It's the interaction of people and how to make it effective. Alan in Boston, thanks for calling, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to speak to the question of, is the book relevant for everyone? And I think it's absolutely true because these are skills that no one teaches you. I myself, as a child, my father was CEO of his own company.
Okay.
So I sort of learned the etiquette from watching how he behaved with his colleagues, with his employees, and being in that environment growing up. So that when I started my own working career, I took for granted that these etiquettes were things that everyone had and observed coworkers who didn't have it and saw the disadvantages they had.
And what's the most important, I don't know, posture at work that you took away from that insight?
Well, for one example, like, as a posture for professionalism is controlling your emotions. I would see coworkers who were incredibly passionate about the work we were doing, but who would literally blow up shouting in the middle of a meeting. And that had to be one of the most unproductive things I'd ever seen happen.
Alan, I'm really glad you raised that. Ross, take on emotion. It shows up in any number of your short chapters here on different ways to work with others at work. Emotion comes back again and again. How do you look at it? It can be nuclear fuel for good or ill.
Yeah, I think sometimes it can clear the air, an outburst or a fight. I think it's always a bad idea. I think it's always a bad idea at work. It never fits into the workplace. You're always going to regret it. I mean, there might be some rare exceptions where things have just gotten totally out of control and things have to be recalibrated with, you know, profanity-laced tirade. I guess I've seen that a couple of times in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I have to imagine that the people I saw do it still think about it today and cringe.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, fighting doesn't work at work, and it doesn't work, I think, anywhere really, because no one is ultimately going to win. You know, mm-hmm. you're not going to win mm-hmm. at work. You know, the business The business can win, you know, at competition. But at work, if you win, if you actually are going in to win, you're going to pay for that, and you're going to pay for that with respect. There's going to be a loss of respect for how you know, quote unquote, won.
Elizabeth, have you seen a change in the acceptance of emotion at work? I guess emotion can be more than blowing up anger. There's many threads of emotion. Are we more open to it? Are we more supple in our workplace socially and accepting of that now? Or is it still too hot to handle at work?
I think it's still a very bad idea. I think it's very, very what Ross is saying is correct. You want to learn to manage it. You know, now we all have emotions, and there are things that are upsetting. And also, one thing that where I've seen emotion is around outside acts. So, you know, going back a little bit, but for September 11th, that was a great bonding experience. I hate to say great, but that was a big bonding experience for many workplaces. You maybe watched it, you know, all day together. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing, when there's an outside event that's upsetting to watch, emotion of a bonding type can be very helpful.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about navigating the workplace, social navigation at work in the 21st century, maybe any century. Ross McCammon is my guest, author of the new book, Works Well With Others. All kinds of advice on all kinds of circumstances at work. It may sound like something out of the Mad Men era, but he says, and I think makes the case, that it's still very much a live issue today. Joins us from New York. From Miami, Elizabeth Bernstein is here. She writes about relationships at work all the time for the journal in her Bonds column. What's your big workplace challenge? What tangles you up? What's your operating philosophy? Are you working with a Steve Jobs at your workplace, a jerk and genius, or just a jerk? Ross, give us some crisp items here, things you should never say in a professional setting. In 2015, what's on your list?
Well, the first one would be, it is what it is. That you hear a lot these days. And I don't know what it means, because of course it is what it is. It was what it was. It will be what it will be. Now, I did have one reader send me a note on Twitter to say that I'm an engineer and the data is the data. So it is what it is. So I guess if you're an engineer, you can keep
it. The data is the data. All right.
but for all the rest of us, we got to come up with something else. The other one is, everything happens for a reason. I hear that a lot.
Passively steered ships here.
Yeah. I'd also like to recommend that we stop grabbing things.
Like,
so
what?
We're constantly grabbing. Can you grab a coffee? Can you grab lunch? I'd like to say that we should have lunch.
Okay.
We shouldn't just be grabbing each other and hot coffee. I think that's a bad idea.
Or also suggesting that it's just quick and maybe meaningless.
Well, that's it. I think that a little commitment is a wonderful thing.
We've got people with rules of their own. John says, please put your computer and mobile devices on mute. I don't want to be alerted to all of your text calls and IMs. And do not microwave fish. How's that for office etiquette here?
You get popcorn a lot, too. You'll get the popcorn wafting through the office.
Yeah. Nick says soft skills more important than hard skills. A nice person, well-liked, can bridge their hard skill gap with the boss. You write, interestingly, Ross, that in your first, months at a job, don't be too good. What do you mean?
Well, I think you probably shouldn't be too good at the job that you just started. If you're really, really good at it, you're probably overqualified, that it's not challenging enough. That I think it's important, especially when you're really just starting out, either in a new job or a new career, that you allow yourself to make a lot of mistakes and that you allow other people to point out those mistakes to you. I think one mistake that I made when I came to Esquire is that I just stayed late in the office working on an individual headline for hours. You try to perfect it when you can't do that. It's just not possible, and you can't do that with any kind of work. And you should understand that you're not going to be perfect, especially right out of the gate. You never will be, but especially right out of the gate. And that the most important thing to do is give your work to other people, either a colleague or your boss, to get feedback and to make it better. Ultimately, it's a much more efficient process.
Ross McCammon and Elizabeth Bernstein here. Edward's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Edward, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. When you introduced the show and you were talking about changing work environments, that really describes my experience. I've been out of school for about 3 years now, and I'm a graphic artist, and every job I've had has been either freelance or permalance, which is basically legally freelance, but I work full-time in on-site using only their equipment. And I've had jobs that are permalance that have lasted over a year, year and a half, 2 years.
Permalance. I love or hate that phrase, but it's a situation a lot of people find themselves in, though, Edward. You're not alone in this.
And I think that the thing for me is that a lot of the traditional workspace sort of etiquette has the sense that you're in an agreement with the employer, that you're both bound to each other, that to fire you is a hassle. But with permalance, I've been let go on a day's notice. And so it's a different dynamic where I always feel like I'm in this mercenary mode, and so is everyone else I work with. So I feel like that some of the most difficulty I've had is in navigating how to be collegial and at the same time always be protective of myself and be ready to, at any moment, I'm going to have the rug pulled out from under me. And I can't even collect unemployment once I'm fired because I was technically freelance.
I'm very glad you raised that. Elizabeth Bernstein, it is true that a lot of the talk about etiquette at the workplace seems to presuppose a kind of firm floor under people. But many, many Americans are in Edward's circumstance where they don't have any guarantee of long-term employment, even if they're not freelancers or permalance. How does that change the quality of interaction, Elizabeth.
It makes it, you know, there's a lot more anxiety with it, right? So, and he's right. There's a lot of people in this position. And frankly, many people who work full time on staff still feel that impermanence. They still are worried about their jobs in this environment we've been in for a number of years. So that goes back to the premise of this whole conversation, is that those relationships you have with people are very important because they can be protective. If if someone likes you, you're working with them, that's, they like your work, that's great. But if they like your work and they like you as a person, you do have more protection. You're a little more valuable to them.
But Ross, maybe the employer doesn't even really look that deeply into you. I mean, if you can be let go at any second, maybe it's just deliver me the work and the rest I don't want to hear about. I mean, here's Gus writes to us. He says, at my current job, management expects employees to work with whatever they're given. Employees are expected to work well with pessimists, overcome unreasonable requests, be content with poor working conditions. Now, some of those may be eternal challenges, but, you know, is there actually less concern about the human being doing the work in the kind of economy we've got now, Ross?
Well, you know, I can't speak to employers, you know, and that's my book is from the perspective of the employee. And so that's the side of things that I can speak to. And what's interesting about what Edward said is while he is in a much more precarious situation than I am. Now, I work for a big company, a corporation, and they have good benefits. And, it would take some process to remove me. Mm-hmm. But I feel what he says rings true for me now. And I think
you feel on that
is right.
Thin ice too, you mean, all the time?
You know, part of me does, yeah. And I think that actually is not – it's kind of a healthy way to feel on some level. I think it can get damaging if you obsess over it. But I feel that way too, and I think Elizabeth is right. There are so many Americans who do have jobs who where they're full-time and they're on board and benefits – that feel this exact way, maybe not exactly, but there's part of it, and that's what is kind of an undercurrent of this book.
Can be gone at any minute.
We're not a family, We're not. This isn't. We didn't. This isn't a family of people. These are coworkers, and you learn real fast. I think it was Tereska was talking about. Mm-hmm. About the sort of culture issues there, you learn real fast when things aren't good. You learn real fast how the hierarchy works. You learn really quickly how a company actually thinks, and the culture just immediately goes away, and the profit is the number one thing. So I think it's healthy for all of us to feel this way. It's kind of inevitable for me. It's just in my nature.
Welcome to the roller derby there. Elizabeth, a healthy thing there? Are we all sort of drinking the dog-eat-dog Kool-Aid?
No, I think it is healthy to remember that, we're all have our necks on the line, so to speak. We work, again, like Ross is saying, this is not a big happy family. We may work in a good environment or a bad one, but even the people who work in a good environment, you may, be at risk of being laid off for no reason. Your boss may love you, and it isn't that person's decision. So I do think it's healthy to remember that, and that would lead you back to hopefully behaving in ways that would help you. So you want to get along with people. You want to be the person who steps up. You want them to like you. These things you can remember to do.
Sarah in Hanover, New Hampshire. Thanks for calling, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm calling looking for a little advice. I'm relatively new to leadership. I work at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, and I was a staff nurse for years, and I've been in a leadership role where I am a face that's seen by all the other leaders in the organization, as well as all the staff nurses in the organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking to get some advice on how to formulate the boundary between still being that leadership person that the staff nurses are comfortable coming to and can socialize, but maintaining the professionalism.
So between sort of friend and boss in a way.
Right.
Ross, I'll go first to you.
Well, I think if you can combine, a generally congenial and affable manner with decisiveness and structure and the occasional order, that people will get it. to me, that is, for a manager, that's the combination, that you there is an undercurrent of, you know, amiableness. And with the occasional, I'm the boss, and this is what we're going to do, and I need you to do this. That, to me, is the way to do it.
There's a couple of chapters I can't use the language in, but you say, you talk about being a jerk or being almost a jerk, and you say this doesn't really convey words I can't use here, but almost a jerk. How much whip are you cracking there, Ross?
Well, I think this goes back to the intimidation chapter in the book, that if you – and I think this actually speaks to Sarah's point, is that what she should be, I think, is passively intimidating. I think that is a very healthy thing for a boss to be, who is intimidating because of how they do their jobs, but not because of any one thing that they're saying to any one employee. But there's a difference. You know, there – you can actively be menacing, and this in my book, that chapter is not really referring to what bosses do, but what, you know, colleagues do. And you can be a roadblock and very, very difficult to work with. But I actually have always kind of enjoyed having those people around, because they, in addition to their obliviousness and their narcissism and their delusion, they are also utterly predictable. So it is a value that, like, if they're in a meeting, you always know what they're bringing to the meeting. It's always something you can account for. And usually most other people who you work with feel exactly the same way. And I think a workplace, it's always good for a workplace to have, you know, one thing or one person who everybody agrees upon. It builds camaraderie.
Boy, I don't know. We're talking social navigation at work. The phrase there, passive intimidation. I don't know. Nadia, Miami, Florida. Nadia, you're on the air.
I'm here. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that I think many of the callers are missing the point. The reason that we, you know, treat each other well in the workplace isn't always just for job security. I mean, it shouldn't always be a means to an end.
Yeah.
The reason that we treat each other well and amicably is so that we can have peace in our lives, so that we can go to work, whether it's for a month, a year, 10, whatever, and be happy to be there and be able to be productive people and to enjoy our time there because we spend so much time there. So I think the greater point is being missed here. You know, having a good sense of politics in the office has to do with just being happier in life in general, whether or not you're staying in a job. I mean, nothing lasts forever. I don't care how secure you think that, you know, your career is. Nothing lasts forever. But we still have to have peace and joy in our lives every day.
Nadia, I'm so glad you called to say that. That is fantastic. Now, Ross McCammon, is that not how it works in Manhattan? I mean, I'm down with Nadia there. Treat each other well and amicably to be happy in life.
I am too. In fact,
I didn't see that chapter, Ross.
She articulates a theme throughout the book, and you might not see it in the chapter headlines, but that is, I think, the point. And Elizabeth brought it up earlier, that we often spend more time with our coworkers than we spend with, you know, our families. I certainly do. I have two children who I see, you know, Bob, my neighbor at work, more than I do my son and daughter. And, you know, the point ultimately is a human point. It's about, you know, the themes in this book are empathy, you know, certainly hard work, but understanding is a big one. And when you understand people, when you are curious about other people, curiosity is such an underrated virtue of the workplace. When you're actually curious about other people, about not only their work, but their personal lives, you'll find that I think you do become closer and you work better together. Nadia couldn't be more right about this.
Elizabeth, we wonder where the economy's been these last few years, been a very tough economy, if that human factor gets diminished or strengthened as people band together, or are we driven to, you know, protect what's ours at the workplace?
I think it gets strengthened because I think that layoffs and the economy can be so stressful that, you know, we seek out support. And who's going to, you know, be supportive of these people we spend a lot of time with who, let's face it, become our friends, you know, hopefully if we're lucky. A lot of our best relationships, I know mine are, a lot of my best friends have come out of workplaces. So I think that that is a wonderful thing, that we can keep that going, that people are strengthened. We support each other because you can lose your job, but that friendship you have forever may be more important.
Well, let's hope. Sarah writes to us on Facebook about her colleagues. I embrace their quirks. After all, she writes, they put up with me. There's a good give and take, I think, and maybe we'll close it right there. Elizabeth Bernstein writes the Bonds column on relationships for the Wall Street Journal. Joined us today from Miami, Florida. Elizabeth, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And Ross McCammon, business etiquette columnist for Entrepreneur Magazine, senior editor at Esquire, and author of Works Well with Others. Ross, good luck in all of your office socializing, and thank you very much for your advice and time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.